This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are exposed. And in this new series, we investigate the dark side of the wellness industry, following the story of a woman who joined a yoga school only to uncover a world she never expected.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this.
Where the hope of spiritual breakthroughs leaves people vulnerable to exploitation.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
World of Secrets, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Richtig spannend, richtig vielfältig. Das ist deine Karriere bei Kaufland. Ob Trainee-Programm, Direkteinstieg, Studentenjob oder Praktikum. Finde bei uns den Einstieg, der zu dir passt. Profitiere von einer attraktiven Vergütung, spannenden Aufgaben und individuellen Entwicklungsmöglichkeiten. Werde jetzt Teil unseres Teams. Bewirb dich jetzt unter kaufland.de/studenten. Kaufland, hier bin ich richtig.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Leanna Byrne, and on this edition, President Biden blocks a $15 billion takeover of US steel by Japan's Nippon Steel, citing national security. Could this decision strain relationships with one of America's closest allies? Digital payments are taking India and many regions in Africa by storm. We'll explore how mobile money is reshaping economies there. And money and relationships, it's not always a match made in heaven. We'll hear how one couple tackled their first big financial fight and came out stronger. Well, if you've got a money relationship story, I want to hear it. You can contact me in WhatsApp or send me a voice note on 0044 330 678 3033, or you can just email us anytime on world.business@bbc.co.uk. But we're going to start with the big news today that US President Biden has blocked that takeover of US Steel. That's the nation's third largest steelmaker by Japan's Nippon Steel. An official statement says the deal posed a risk to national security and critical supply chains. The White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre has said that the US needed to protect themselves against foreign competitors who use unfair trade practices.
It is critical that we have a strong domestic steel industry that protects our national security and our supply chains. Today, the president demonstrated once again that he will always act to protect the security of this nation as well as the resilience of our supply.
Now, this decision raises important questions about the future of global partnerships. Could blocking this deal strain the United States' relationship with key allies like Japan? And I put that question to Lisa Goldenberg, president of Delaware Steel and former president of the Association of Steel Distributors.
I think this is a unique and sort of hot stove topic. The steel industry has always been set aside in a different sort of way when it comes to national security and the fickleness of nationalism. We're not talking about dining room chairs, and we're not talking about housing or offices. We're talking about something that people tend to get fired up about when it comes to steel. It's a separate category. So I don't think that it affects overall blanket statement. And let's not also understand that we just signed a giant deal with Japan on missiles. So it seems that trade in and of itself is alive and well. It's just that this is a particular hot topic.
It is a hot topic. And President Biden, he said he's protecting American steel jobs, which I know is important for a lot of voters. But from your vantage point, does blocking foreign ownership actually translate into job security for people?
I don't know if it's a direct correlation or a dotted line correlation. I think that protecting U.S. manufacturing industry to stay within United States ownership as much as possible does protect jobs. I think there is a mutual shared interest. However, I don't know that it's an exact correlation. For example, if the Japanese were to invest the type of money, several billion dollars that they're talking about to upgrade the systems, on the one hand, they're going to use more robotics and machinery, which eliminates jobs. On the other hand, they're going to modernize and expand, which expands jobs. As well, I think that this is banking on other U.S. investment, which would be better for the union and more protectionistic.
The administration also said a domestically owned steel sector is essential for a resilient supply chain. Is there any specific vulnerabilities that he's talking about there in the supply chain that that decision was aiming to address?
Sure. We are short supply on certain products, particularly in steel in the United States, that we rely on foreign steel to the extent that we can invest more in a domestic industry and allow or create less dependency on foreign supply. So with a Trump administration entering right around the corner that has threatened or promised, depending on how you look at it, to increase foreign tariffs, needing to have that industry controlled domestically is really important.
Now, President Biden, he says the U.S. steel is the cleanest in the world. In practice, how is sustainability improving? Because if you're not bringing in new technologies, and yes, people might lose their jobs, I mean, could it be the case that protectionism is hindering those efforts?
Well, I don't think jobs and greener is necessarily related. However, when you look at green steel, there have been enormous investments within the United States. I was at a seminar a couple of years ago, right before the pandemic, I think, which I guess is more than a couple. Mm-hmm. But what is now one of the Cleveland Cliffs locations has been able to capture poor gases as they escape, recycle them, clean them, and reuse them in the steelmaking process. So although there hasn't been enormous capital investment in the way we're talking about purchasing giant mills, there has been giant strides in the greenification, if you will, of steel and the process therein. As well, with the growth in the mini mill structure, it absolutely increases a greener space and using more resources in a recycling type of capacity. So I don't know that whether the Japanese invest or not affects the commitment to a greener space. I don't even think that there's a direct correlation that I'm aware of.
So what do you think, Lisa, is U.S. steel safe? Because I know there's a lot of people who want this deal to go through.
I think a deal needs to happen. Whether it's with this partner or not is up for debate. Clearly, the Biden administration says not this partner. And it would be a tricky call for the Trump administration. On the one hand, you can't get more protectionistic. And on the other hand, they are making a clear statement that they don't care who's in charge of the unions. So the unions have kind of done a flip-flop in that they're traditionally so supportive of not just Biden, but any Democrat in the White House. And now they've stood behind Trump. So it's very tricky. I think that from a legacy standpoint, the union's far better off keeping Japan out. There's no way that they're going to, over time, continue to uphold all of the union wishes. The Japanese manufacturing structure and culture is very, very different than the union structure. Very different.
That was Lisa Goldenberg, president of Delaware Steel. Also here and listening to that is Chris Lowe, chief economist at FHN Financial, based in New York. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Leona.
Chris, I'm just wondering, does maintaining American ownership of U.S. steel, would that actually contribute to the competitiveness of the U.S. steel industry? Or does it not really matter as long as it's making money?
Well, you know, if you're just talking about this particular deal, it actually weakens the U.S. steel production if we block the deal, because U.S. steel has indicated it needs billions in investment in order to keep its plants open. It has indicated it plans to close several plants if the deal doesn't go through. You know, of course, they might find another partner, but I would think partnering with a friendly competitor rather than one that's less friendly would be preferable.
Well, Lisa seems to think that a deal does need to be done. And I know that there's probably going to be pushback as well on this blocking of the deal as well. Well, Chris, I'm going to leave you hanging there for a little bit because we're going to talk about very much money matters at the moment. Because in the world of scan and pay transactions, India comes out on top. And by 2026, 2027, daily transactions are expected to hit a staggering 1 billion. But what does this shift to a cashless society mean for everyday people there? Suma Day Pal reports from Delhi.
Rupees 30 received on PhonePe. Devyon Sajnod, bahut bahut dhanyawad aapka.
This was how my digital payment of 20 rupees or 30 cents for snacks at a deli shop was announced on a small blue speaker. It is a familiar sight in India, be it buying vegetables to electronics. Customers can use scan and pay method to make payments of any size. I have come to the tribal Lorai village in the eastern Jharkhand state. It is one of the country's most remote regions. Mobile network is patchy here, but aspiration for digital connectivity is leading to creative solutions. John Bandia runs a documentation center.
We dug up the bamboo in the ground. Just like one would hoist a flag, we hoist the Wi-Fi device on the top of the bamboo with the help of a rope. By placing it on top, we access the internet from the ground.
India is witnessing a digital transformation, recording over 440 million daily transactions on its homegrown scan and pay unified payments interface, or UPI. The number is set to grow to a daily billion transactions between 2026 and 2027. The government says that 46% of all real-time payments made worldwide in 2022 were made in India. The country makes more UPI payments than the next four leading countries combined, leaving behind China and the US.
Hello, good morning, ma'am.
31-year-old Priyanka is a trans woman in Delhi. Transgender people in India often struggle to access banking services. But Priyanka's story is different. UPI payments have helped her grow her business globally in a short span.
मैं फुटपाथ पर ही रहती थी मतलब दुकान लगाती थी तो उधर मैं मतलब मैं देखिए चलो दो दिन के लिए बैंक
Earlier I used to live on the pavements. That's where I set up my shop. There was a bank holiday for 2 days, so I could not deposit money and it got stolen. Now I take orders through Instagram and payments through WhatsApp. I had my business in my dead name. I used to run my business. The bank used to open at 10, but we used to queue up by 8 a.m. I now have freedom and I can save my time. I can sit at home and focus on growing my business.
Yeah, business mein apna focus karun to alag kaam ho jata hai mera.
Despite the growth, experts point out the challenges of digital inclusion. Anjali Bhardwaj is a transparency rights activist.
The National Family Health Survey 5 basically showed how only 1 in 3 women had ever accessed the internet. What we just can't avoid and can't look away from in a country like ours is the kind of access issues. If one were to even talk about grievances, if there are problems that they have, they find it much easier to be able to physically go somewhere, to be able to register their complaint, to be able to deal with someone face to face.
Better connectivity is another enormous challenge. 94% of India's villages are covered by at least one mobile tower, but that does not guarantee connectivity. But in Jharkhand's Lorhai village, Vishwanath Kandayat is hopeful.
We are still struggling because we don't have full internet connectivity. Once we have better connectivity here, we are confident that we will be able to touch the skies.
That was Sumadeh Pal reporting from Delhi. Now let's stick with this theme and go to Africa, a continent that is making significant strides when it comes to digital payments. Chilekwa Banda is Chief Commercial Officer at Bridging Gap Solutions. That's a fintech company in Zambia. And she's Vice President in Southern Africa of the Africa Fintech Network. And I asked her what's contributed to the recent boom in online transactions.
We have platforms like M-Pesa in Kenya. We have the mighty Airtel Money and all these mobile network operators. They have actually addressed most of the infrastructure gaps, which has enabled access to financial services. When you look at the northern region, you find that mobile money adoption has been more modest compared to sub-Saharan regions. When you look at the southern Africa, it is more experienced growth in mobile money services. I would give an example of countries like Zambia, for instance, where I'm from. Adapting these platforms has been one of the key strategies. You find their deliberate policies around financial inclusion and digital payments and mobile money payments that are in favor of the consumer and the fintechs across the country. So I think adoption in the southern region has been faster than in the northern region when it comes to mobile money.
I think overall in the continent, though, cash is still very much king. So how are these digital payment providers overcoming this mistrust of online banking and even security concerns sometimes?
Yeah, cash definitely still is king, especially where trust is concerned, like you've mentioned, because whilst it is very easy to provide capacity building initiatives, especially for the rural areas where about 8 years ago, it was said that it's difficult or rather slow progression because they do not understand, but they actually do. It was more to do with trust and security. We're now reaching a point where the banks are slowly phasing out. We have so many banks across the region that have actually gone branchless and they're taking most of their transactions online. So you have more e-commerce platforms, you have more digital wallets coming up, and the usage is massive. You have over 1 billion transactions that are going through these mobile money financial services platforms.
And who is more likely to make a digital payment? Would it be men? Would it be women? Would it be younger, older?
Definitely all three, but maybe percentage-wise, probably 70% would be men. In terms of the gender roles, I think for women, it's not so much that they don't really know how to use digital payments. It's more to do with, I can say here, I'll take it back to culture. Women's saving patterns are obviously better, for lack of a better term, than
women. Are smart, that's okay to say.
Yes, we are smart. The future is female. But but also just from a cultural perspective, I feel like women often shy away from doing most of these transactions online because they don't want a track record of how much money they have in an account, for example, or how they're spending that money. Whereas men, because they control most of the income in most of the households, especially if you go towards the underserved communities, you'll find that even decision-making when it comes to money is really through the head of the house, and that happens to be the man. So culture does affect the subconscious of a woman, no matter how much they try to progress. That's the way I would put it.
And then on the business side, what kind of businesses are more likely to use online payments? Presumably smaller businesses in Africa, wherever they are in different regions, possibly they don't have access to that those types of systems.
Well, definitely with the way the e-commerce platforms have taken over and the way digital payments have taken over, we've had more entrepreneurs coming up. And entrepreneurs obviously are using so many different platforms to sell their products. And in turn, they have different platforms where they need to receive or collect payments from their clients. So that is a good thing, but it's also a disservice to developing African countries where you don't have access to payment platforms. For instance, without, you know, mentioning some of the tools out there, you have some social media platforms that are not enabled for payments in my country, for example. So that's an opportunity for fintechs to actually go into and build platforms that will accept payments. It's actually a call to the regulators as well. This is an opportunity for each ecosystem to build products that will serve the customer and also the provider. And entrepreneurship is the way to go.
That was Chileko Banda, Chief Commercial Officer at Bridging Gap Solutions, a fintech company in Zambia. And you're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service.
What do Tiger Woods, Mark Zuckerberg, and Taylor Swift all have in common? Well, their lives and fortunes are all being discussed on Good Bad Billionaire, the podcast exploring the minds, motives, and the money of some of the world's wealthiest individuals. I'm Xing Xing, and each week my co-presenter Simon Chak and I take a closer look at the world's mega rich, and we try to decide whether they're good, bad, or just another billionaire. From celebs and CEOs to sports stars and tech titans, find out how billionaires made their money and how they use it. Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. All episodes of Season 1 and 2 are available now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And click follow or subscribe so you never miss a new episode.
Chris Lowe is still with me. Chris, really, we have COVID to thank for speeding up the growth of digital payments, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in China, where COVID began, it almost all retail transactions now are digital. And here in the US and in Europe too, the digital has taken off, partly because we were nervous about the virus transmitting on currency.
And we never went back. That's it. Now, Chris, another story that I noticed today that caught my eye. Apple recently agreed to a $95 million settlement with users who accused Siri of eavesdropping on their private conversations. I mean, people are always talking about that, aren't they? But do you think this settlement really signals a broader trend of increasing legal and regulatory scrutiny for tech companies? Because there seems to be stories like this coming out all the time now.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is it's really pretty dark in a way, because what happened in this particular suit, Apple was accused of selling the information to advertisers who then used it to pitch products at people. The fact they paid a settlement suggests that perhaps that's exactly what they were doing. We all have these devices in our pockets, in our homes. It really is something to think about.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, speaking about in the home, Chris, we're going to be talking about money matters and love and relationships. I mean, does that ever crop up in any of your relationships, Chris, any arguments over money?
Oh, my goodness, yes. We're my wife and I live in New York City, which is very expensive, very high tax. I would love to move to Florida, where tax rates are lower, and we have an office. I could work down there. Needless to say, because she doesn't, we're staying right here.
Oh, well, Mrs. Lowe, she has the final say. All right. Chris Lowe, thank you so much for joining us. So let's move on, because it is that time of year where you might be taking a hard look at your finances, and money matters can be a tricky topic for any couple. In fact, 2023 study then found that finances are behind 40% of couples' arguments, and these disagreements often keep resurfacing because our beliefs and habits around money are deeply ingrained. But there is hope. Rima Carrera, host of Marketplace's This Is Uncomfortable podcast, shares a story about Alex and Jamie, a couple who successfully navigated one of their first money-related disagreements.
Last year, Jay Benedith and Ben Williams matched on a dating app and clicked right away. On paper, they're pretty different.
So I'm Afro-Latina.
I'm white.
I'm Buddhist.
I'm from a Jewish family.
I grew up in New York City and very much a city girl.
I grew up in the suburbs of Ohio.
And they soon discovered they have very different approaches to money. Ben tries to spend within his means, but he doesn't stress about it. Jay, on the other hand, is frugal. She tracks every penny that comes in and out of her bank account. Early on, as you can imagine, it led to some issues.
I've heard about the seltzer incident. can you all tell me about that? What happened?
Oh my, Jay, you want me to take this one?
Yeah.
All right. It was Friday night, and I was cooking us dinner. Bought a little wine, steaks, baked potatoes, you know, veggies, some dessert.
Whenever they'd go out to eat, they'd split the bill. But since Ben was cooking at home, this was his treat. As Jay was heading over to Ben's place, she stopped at the store and asked if he needed anything. Ben said, sure, can you grab me some seltzer?
She bought me this pack of seltzer for $5, and she had Venmo'd me.
I don't drink seltzer. So, like, if I was also going to drink it, then I would have charged him for half of it.
wait. You would have charged him for $2.50?
Yes.
No.
Rima.
I don't think I Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, Ben was pretty annoyed when he got that Venmo request.
It didn't land right because I had just spent like a good amount of money on this nice meal and not charged her a cent. And then she had asked me if I wanted anything. And then it was followed up with a request.
This kind of thing happened a few times where Ben felt nickel and dimed. In the past, it would have been enough for Ben to run. But he really loves Jay. So instead of avoiding, they talked about it. And his views softened the more he learned about Jay's upbringing.
There were, like, nights where, like, we didn't quite know what we were going to eat. And there were some holidays where, like, if I didn't buy presents, like, no one was getting presents.
She told Ben about her sweet 16, the first time she got a large sum of money.
I was like, okay, so what am I going to do with this? And then eventually, like, I opened up a Chase account. And so being very careful with, like, how I spend my money is, like, very built into my, like, DNA.
They both started opening up about their financial backgrounds.
My dad has been able to build a law practice that has given me a safety net. And that's something that, like, I'm really grateful for. But I think part of the privilege of money is also not having to think about it too much.
I'm coming from a place of, like, coming up to this middle place. And Ben, it seems like you're coming to the middle from a more upper place, if that makes sense. And so even though, like, at this point, like, we make generally the same amount of money, like, we generally live a similar lifestyle, I think that, like, our starting places are showing up in where we are right now.
Even so, about 6 months into the relationship, Ben started to wonder if Jay would ever be willing to treat him to something without it being a gift or a special occasion. Then one night, he was coming back from a trip.
I hadn't had a chance to go grocery shopping and I didn't have any food at my house. And I asked her to pick me up a sandwich and she got me a Potbelly sandwich and did not send a Venmo request.
Aww. Was that difficult to resist?
No, it was totally fine.
Yeah. Jay says there was a moment when she thought about Venmoing him, but then she looked at the bigger picture. She loves Ben and she wanted to make sure he has something to eat.
What's something you learned from the other person about money and how to spend it?
I think from Jay, I asked myself the question more like, do I need this? And like not do I want this or can I afford this?
These days, Ben spends a little less on Uber Eats, does a little more meal prep at home, and he's saving more for retirement.
I think something that I've learned from Ben is to not just think about, like, me and my own little financial bubble and just being more mindful and considerate of, like, how they handle money.
Having those honest conversations have helped them meet in the middle, and they're about to have a lot more of them. They just got engaged and are getting married next year.
Well, I'm getting married this year, and I know that's going to be really expensive. That report by Rima Carrera, host of Marketplace's This Is Uncomfortable podcast. And that's it from World Business Report from the BBC World Service. David Kahn and Emmy Rhodes are our producers today. Lexi O'Connor is the editor, and I'm Leanna Byrne. Thanks so much for listening, and tune in again soon.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohammed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.